Accession number 30407, Mr. Ralph Curtin, Reel 8. Now, before we go on, I mean, we've sort of jumped a bit ahead to when you leave, but I mean, you actually go to Southampton first.
Yeah.
Bovington. And then Southampton, sorry.
Yeah.
Now, you go to Bovington, it looks like for about 30 days. Now, what happened at Bovington?
Well, I went through the usual, kitting out again, inoculations.
That's the RAC depot.
RAC depot, Bovington, yes.
And anything different about it? I mean, you've done this before, but I mean...
No, it's the same procedure. Lectures. What we possibly might expect when we get there. To be reviewed en route and updated as such. And it was generally accepted that we were kitted out with ordinary British battle dress, greatcoats, gloves, woolen underwear, usual stuff associated with troopers and the army in general, and sent on leave. And that was where I had the inoculations as such, and again I got down to Bournemouth to pick up the train and spent some leave with Mum and Dad. And then back to Bovington, where we were transported to Southampton and put on the Empire ferry for transportation to Korea.
Now, did you know which unit you were going to?
Yes.
Now, which unit were you meant to be going to?
The...
They had a particular tank, didn't they? I think they were going to identify...
Churchill unit.
So, as far as you were concerned, things were... Now, you looked up the order of battle, and you think it was C Squadron of the 7th Royal Tank
Regiment.
So that was what you thought you were going to. How did you feel about that? Well, I mean,
well, it wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted to do was join, obviously, my brother in the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars.
So at the time when you were going, you were pretty worried about that.
I was, yeah.
Now, what was the voyage like? Did you volunteer for the kitchen or?
I did. I always do. Yes. I volunteered. It was okay going out through the British Channel again, English Channel. Actually, we got to Singapore.
Now, anything happened en route?
Oh, well, we went through the channel, through the canal as usual, and going through there, we got the usual shout, get your knees brown, from the boys on the shore, and so on and so forth. We had a route launch, actually.
At Suez?
At the Suez, yes. We were allowed off at Suez. Then we got to Singapore, and we were transferred to the aircraft carrier Unicorn.
So nothing else happened on the way out?
No.
So you were still going to 7th RTR at this stage? And this would be in, November, roughly? Mm. Now, did you get ashore at Singapore?
No, we were transferred straight off.
Now, what was it like aboard HMS Unicorn?
Well, that was interesting because... we ran in the course of the voyage on the boat deck, on the top deck, the flight deck. They had a Ranson and Rapier crane, which was shackled, and the ship got into bad weather, and it turned out to be the edge only the edge of a typhoon. And if you've ever been on an aircraft carrier on the edge of a typhoon, it's going up and down like a lift. We actually tied a piece of string with a boot on it as an angle to see how far the ship was rolling one way and the other. And it was fantastic when it was going to. And that was in the bowels of the ship, really. We were four decks down. And we heard that this rumbling going on the flight deck, and apparently the Ransom and Rapier crane, which is something like 15 tons or something, had broken loose, and it was running and rumbling right the way down when she dipped and right the way back when she, you know. And eventually it went over the side, and sort of, and it took the captain's gig, which all that was left of it was two davits hanging on end of the securing ropes, and the rest of it had gone. And it put some dents in there, some pom-poms on the side in some of the shields on the way out.
And what was it like for you?
Hairy. You couldn't go on the flight deck. You didn't go anywhere near. Anywhere near.
You get washed off?
No. Oh, it, me?
You, if you went on it,
you'd... Oh, you would. You couldn't stick your head out. So eventually we got through that and everything calmed down again. And we arrived at Sasebo in Japan.
At where?
Sasebo. Now, in the journey to Sasebo, I realised if I was going to do anything at all, I'd better do something about changing where I was going to.
Now, how are you going to do that? How are you going to do that?
So I spoke to one of the staff sergeants with the Eighth Hussars contingent and explained the situation.
There were some Eighth Hussars people aboard.
Oh, yes, there was a big draft, Eighth Hussars on board. I spoke to the sergeant, staff sergeant, and explained the situation that I'd been trying to join the Eighth Hussars. And he said, well, I can give you a badge, change your badge, and he said, I'll put you on my rota, or roster, rather, and he said, we'll take it from there. So that's what we did.
No, that's completely illegal, not illegal, well, illegal.
It was illegal.
It's certainly against Army
regulations. Army rules and regulations. So, we arrived in Sasebo and we were taken to a camp, a transit camp.
Is that Kure?
Kure, yes.
What was happening at Kure camp?
We were being kitted out, extra inoculations, and we were given the latest information as to what the situation was and where the regiment was. And said that we'd be allocated to which squadron and what we were doing when we arrived in Korea.
Now, were you given any training in Korea?
No, not at all.
And who was in your draft? How were you getting on with the lads from the...
Oh, it was all right. Obviously, one or two of the chaps, especially the staff sergeant, knew Corporal Curtin in the regiment. And
so he was senior, of course, because Corporal Curtin.
He was my younger brother.
My younger brother was
he was senior to me, yes. Which I didn't mind anyway.
And who was the staff sergeant? Do you remember his name?
No.
But you got on well with this draft. I mean, it was a good start.
Oh, yeah, we got on well, and we all knew that we were going out there, and we realised, you know, things were getting serious, and you had to start looking after things, especially each other and so on and so forth. And obviously, eventually, we were shipped out, we were flown in, and we arrived at Kimpo Airport.
To where?
Kimpo.
Where's that, sorry?
In Korea, South Korea.
It's not at Seoul, is it? Or?
Yeah, it's one side of Seoul, yeah. Yeah. And from
was
there...
Was that your first flight?
Yes.
Any impact? Any...
Yeah, it was American, a big transport plane. Big transport. I've got pictures.
Oh, it's all right. They won't be able to see it.
Anyway, yeah, it was a big American transport plane.
So you got there in November 50, early November from the looks of it, 3rd of November from the date on here. Although you can't quite tell because the dates jump from
jumping in.
So what happened when you got there?
Well, we were allocated to various units. I was attached as a driver to Captain Astley Cooper.
Now, hang on. So, which troop and
this is Cooper Force.
Nah, we haven't mentioned Cooper Force before. Who Cooper Force?
Cooper Force was Cooper Force was Cromwell's Trooper Cromwell's, supported by another troop of artillery Cromwell's, and a mortar battalion, a mortar unit,
and sappers. This straight away.
Yes, I was allocated straight away.
Straight away.
Straight away. And once he arrived at the regiment, 2 or 3 days, I was inducted.
And it was just known as Cooper Force. It wasn't given a squadron. You weren't part of the standard regimental structure.
Within the regiment, Cooper Force was formed from within the regiment.
That's right. So you were with the regiment, but you were Cooper Force as a separate part of it. You were there as a driver.
Yeah, I was driving Captain Astley Cooper as a driver, a Jeep driver.
Tell me what did you think of, what was your role as driver? I think we better sort that out.
Well, my role as Jeep driver to the captain was to take him from various places he wanted to go and be around and available at all times as and when he required me. Which was quite a lot because it was very active at the time. And
can you give us a little? I mean, if you can remember, what Astley Cooper was, because he's not that well known.
No,
Well, what
I didn't.
Was he like?
I didn't know him too well. I suppose I knew him for about a week. He's quite a decent chap, actually. Always treated me well. And
but you didn't get a chance to know.
I didn't get a chance to know him that well. I used to take him to various places, various units, and mostly backwards and forwards from HQ regiment up to Cooper Force position.
And whereabouts were you with Cooper Force with the regiment?
We were in what they call Happy Valley, as it is known now.
And where's that near? Now, we've looked at, you were in the Happy Valley, which is next to the Imjin. It is the Imjin Valley, at that part.
Yeah.
And you're leading up, of course, to what we'll do next time, which is this business in January, where Cooper Force was very badly
wiped out.
Is another word for it. Yes, that's right. But before then, we'll go on to the, we'll sort of save that till next time. What about, what was the setup in Happy Valley? Do you see what I mean? What were the conditions you were living in? What were you living in?
Well, it was extremely difficult because by this time, of course, it was getting quite cold. In fact, terribly cold.
I was going to say, you don't mean quite. How cold was it?
It really was cold. At one stage, it was down to 48 degrees. At one stage, basically, it was well below 20. Normally about 25-30. It was extremely cold, and to start with, we had only the British battle dress on, long johns, greatcoats, and the equipment as such for that temperature was inadequate, totally inadequate.
Now, what was it like? I mean, because you can say these figures, but English people just don't experience that kind of
thing. Let me tell you this, you couldn't touch any metal, if you did with your bare hands, it'd rip the skin right off, no problem. You couldn't shave properly. if you boil the water and you poured a kettle of boiling water, and by the time it reached the floor, it was solid ice. The tanks had pure glycol in the finish, in the radiators, and even that froze. The temperature was such that you couldn't go on guard duty for no more than 15, 20 minutes. If you did, you'd freeze. In with the conditions of the equipment that we'd got, like the ordinary British battle dress stuff, it wasn't good enough for the temperatures. Very inadequate. Consequence of which, later on in the story,
you get new stuff. You get new equipment as well.
Yes.
For the first month or so, you're just freezing.
We're just freezing.
Did it depress you a bit at that? Oh,
you couldn't think. You couldn't feel. The machinery wouldn't work. What they had to do in the finish was, some of the villages were not inhabited. So what the chaps did, they used to take the roof. The roofs had thatched roofs, and they used to strip the thatch off, and they laid it down on the ground and rolled the tanks. They eventually found how to keep the tanks mobile, was by rolling the tanks over this thatch as such, and then they would have to sleep with the bivouac attached to the side of the tank. And they had little burners, little Bunsen burners that they had in sleeping bags.
Did you have to keep restarting and running?
We had to run the. That was the thing. That was a dead giveaway, really, for any enemy that was around. When you started the engine up, of course, the noise was tremendous, and that gave away any position anywhere. And you had to do that every 15, 20 minutes.
Now, if you didn't do it, what would happen?
The engine would seize up solid, lock up solid.
And was that a major
repair
job?
Oh, well, yes, it was an engine change in the field. And it was experienced 2 or 3 times.
So you'd have to do this with your Jeep as well, I presume?
Keep it running.
So who would do that? Who would get up every 15 minutes and start it? Or was it that one person would start all of them?
They did it in relays, yeah.
So it was quite well organised?
Oh, it was highly organised in the finish, but to start with. The turrets used to lock solid on the Travis rings. They were all iced up.
Did you have antifreeze, such as it was?
Pure glycol.
And that's what you eventually used?
Yeah, pure glycol, and even that was mushy. Mushy.
So the antifreeze was freezing?
Freezing. Lubricants didn't work. The normal standard lubricating oil did not work.
Now, what were you living in this in Happy Valley?
Well, whatever you could find. Whatever you found. If you were lucky and you moved into an area where there was a village, unfortunately, although it was in war, the people got turfed out, because what they did is they knew how cold it got in Korea over the centuries, and they had their houses had underfloor heating, which was stoked up by obviously wood embers and whatever, and they always nice and warm.
So you'd take them?
We would take them out. If we could keep them in and also get in ourselves, we did. But generally speaking, it's a question of survival of the fittest, and we were defending a country, and we thought we were more needy of that.
So you'd live in their houses. What if you couldn't get in one of them? Well, you mentioned bivouacs.
We had to, or you dug in if you could, breaking into ground with pickaxe. It was like nothing on earth. Was try and get into a dig into the bank or into a hillside and try and construct something. The other thing we did...
Because they used to do that a lot later on. I mean, dugouts and bunkers.
Bunkers. Well, dugouts.
Did you have a bunker at that time, or were you living in a Korean village?
Well, we lived in a certain amount of Korean villages, but they came few and far between. The vast majority of the time, one had to make do and mend. And
so you try and dig a dugout?
You try and dig something. And what we did was the shell cases... of the Centurions were very tall, yeah. And what we did was we would make a hole in the bottom, and all round the casing we would get a pickaxe and make a lot of holes around it and make it into a Bunsen burner, as it were. And then what we did, we got a section of them in a quarter half circle, poured petrol into them, and you would have a little trail of petrol from them and 2 or 3 yards away, and then strike a match, and off it would go, and of course it would all roar up.
Now, is this in a dugout, or a bunker,
no,
or is this in the open?
This is in the open.
So this is just open heating?
Mm. To start with. And then we adapted them to one where we had the 45th Artillery, had smaller shells, and when we were able to get hold of them, excuse me, we converted them into little heaters and put an extension on the top, and we built the dugout round that, and had a jerry can with a little feed in to it to help you give some warmth.
Now, what about the dugouts? What would the dugout look like when you built a good one?
A good one? Well, it would be some of the local building material, i.e. timber frames and stuff. You had to build them when the weather was right. And the thing was, once you got them settled, having got them all nice and you were moved. So if you were lucky and you moved into another position, if it was a brand new one, you were out of luck. If you were lucky, and they
were these mainly moves within Happy Valley.
Yes.
But you'd be shifted about.
We shifted about.
And what would be in the dugout? I mean, how deep, how big?
Well, we got hold of some American folding canvas beds, and we got hold of some fleece lined sleeping bags, again, from the Americans, you know.
So you'd steal them?
Yes, we did. In fact, a story that I could tell you is that on one of the surges of the country, we came across an American depot. And this American depot was absolutely smart. It was pebbles and lined, and trucks lined absolutely side by side. And these American lorries, convoy lorries, they were full. In the back, you'd have a full load of ammunition, a full load of petrol, a full load of tools, a full load of clothing, and everything that the Americans wanted, tents, God knows what. And consequently, my brother and I came across, this is for later on, really, we came across this American depot, and there was nobody there. They'd gone. They'd just abandoned it. They'd just got in and gone. So it came up on the air and told the colonel. The column we were in, with tanks and vehicles, and jeeps and so on and so forth, and he dismounted every one of them. He checked one driver and one tank commander, and all the chaps that could drive, and all of them could. We then got into as many of these trucks as we had personnel, and drove them away. And they're full up with petrol, and keys were still in. We were the best supported armoured fighting column in Korea.
But that's later.
That's though. Later.
That's a good story to tell now. Now, one thing I should have got, and I want to ask you now in case I forget next time, we've not got long left this time. What about when your brother saw you, when you turned up?
Ah, yes.
There might be a story there. What, I mean, what happened when you got there?
Well, I arrived in the regiment in very late afternoon, early evening, actually, and I asked at the what was the HQ, where Corporal Curtin was, and he said, in C Squadron, HQ Squadron. And
what was his first name, just so we've got it?
Dennis Norman Curtin, Corporal Dennis Norman Curtin. And they said, well, we know roughly where he is, but you'll have to get to this point and find out yourself. So eventually I got pointed in the right direction. And he was in this building, for want of a better word. I think it was an old schoolhouse. And there were bodies lying all over the floor, and they were all sleeping. And I was doing this, and the chap would wake up, and he said, "No, I'm not Curtin." And in the finish, I found Dennis, and he was in the far corner, right up the other end. And he said, "Where have you been? Where have you been all this time?" I said, "En route to come here, you so and so."
So he knew you were coming.
He knew I was coming. My father had written to him to say that I was coming out. So he knew.
Was he pleased to see you?
I think he was. Yes, he was. But we were separated, you know, for quite a time.
And you pleased to see him, of course.
Oh, of course. But as much as we could, like, if I was back, he'd be waiting, and if he was out, I'd be waiting, you know, and for to see him come back.
So there's a mutual support there.
Oh, yeah.
That helped
yeah.
you both.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, how are you fitting in with the unit? What did you think of it? I mean, I know you're only there about a month before the Cooper Force gets smashed up. But were they a good bunch of lads? How were you fitting in?
Oh, well? Terrific bunch of lads.
What was so good about them?
The esprit de corps, the high level of training, it was evident in everything they did.
So, I mean, you've been in units before, you've been in 43rd, you've been in...
Yeah.
They stood out, did they?
They stood out.
In what way, then?
They were so well trained, and they had such a feeling of a centurion, and the way it worked, and the power in that tank. They felt, what's the word, highly secure, not vulnerable in any shape or form, pride in the fact of what it could do and how it worked, and the tremendous hitting power that it had. There wasn't a tank at that stage in Korea that could touch it.
Now, you didn't know much about it, I presume. I mean, at that stage.
At that stage. I found out, though.